The Ascent of Board Games is a podcast in which we discuss the history and evolution of board game mechanics, concepts, and themes from the dawn of history to today's newest releases. We talk, we laugh, we pick on each other, and we occasionally get things wrong. But we hope to provide both entertainment and education to today's discerning podcast listener, you.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 61 of the Ascent of Board Games. We're using a trimmed-down elite crew today. Jason and Curtis are unavailable for various family obligations and that sort of thing, but it's not going to stop us. We are here to talk about games. I got Mike and Joe and Frank, and that's really the core. Don't tell the other guys.
Wow, totally dissed.
This month, we wanted to talk about games with nonverbal communication methods.
So we're talking about not talking.
It's going to be a very strange podcast. You're just going to hear a lot of grunts and moving of people.
I mean, honestly, it's just going to be an hour of just dead air.
I mean, we could do that. No, I think we should talk about not talking. So these are games where, obviously, in a lot of games, you explain what you're doing, or you talk to your teammates, or you indicate what's going on. And in these games, you can't do that, or at least you can't do it with words. So you have to basically make moves or do things within the game that will indicate what's going on without just telling them. I was kind of surprised at how many of these there are, and many of them are good, and some of them are also games.
Hey.
So.
And just to clarify, we're also leaving out ones that are like, we are still talking. So it's not like we're giving single word clues.
Right.
We are going completely nonverbal.
Completely nonverbal. That is the plan.
Completely nonverbal from the primary person.
Right. There may be periods when there is some talking, but like the major function of the game is done with a different kind of communication. We'll walk through it. We'll see how it goes. Basically, as is traditional with us by now, we're going to talk about a bunch of games that are vaguely themed together, and we'll see what happens. So this kind of thing actually started quite a long time ago.
Yeah. The first game on this list is probably unsurprising to anybody, is charades. Or if you're fancy, charades.
I don't think anyone says that.
Damn it. So this was 1550 as like a publication date? Where did that come from?
It's interesting. They actually start with a bunch of riddles. Written riddles that clue the individual syllables of a word. And that's from the 18th century, so I'm not sure where Board Game Geek gets its information. They probably know more about this than I do. But it's interesting to see how it has evolved into the kind of standardized party game that we know now.
So in charades, one person is acting out a concept, for lack of a better term. They can do it in any way they want. That is nonverbal. You know, I think that this is a well-known enough concept that it really just maybe took somebody in the 1500s to finally put it down on paper of like, hey, this is an activity that we're doing. You know, there are some generally accepted strategies to this game. For example, always indicating person, place, or thing, or movie title, or how many words a thing consists of.
Breaking something down into syllables.
It sounds like, yeah.
Yep.
Set a give?
It's charades. You know, we don't need to get into too much more detail than that. Act things out, be silly. There are, of course, some more recent games that involve some aspects of this, like Time's Up is a classic one where you have a list of famous people that you're going through, and first you have to just describe them, and then you get a one-word clue, and then you have to just do like a signal or a charades to try and indicate who they are.
Charades and sound, yep.
Oh, that's the game that if you wave your fingers in front of your face like Cthulhu, that clearly means Scooby-Doo.
Woodstock, I think, is how it worked.
What? Yeah, Woodstock, exactly. Yes.
I still don't know how that worked, but. Yeah, Time's Up is a lot of fun. So, yeah, charades is, I think, not something that, quote-unquote, real gamers are going to be playing a lot these days, but it's...
Hey!
How often do you play charades?
We'd play Time's Up.
Right, exactly.
Fair. I do have a box charade set from the 80s, which probably needs to come out.
It's just a list of things you have to act out?
We played that to death in the time.
So, moving on. Frank is out of the game here that I know nothing about, so he's going to have to tell me.
Yeah, of course.
What?
I know. How weird is that?
Yeah, no, and I'm not going to get any points for this one because it's just a standard of traditional trick-taking game called Briscola. Briscola. Who knows? It's Italian from the 16th century. And it's a pretty simple, basic trick-taking game from the structure. You know, you're dealt three cards. You basically play a card. Highest card wins or the highest trump. The rankings are a little weird. Ace, three, king, queen, jack. And point values for the highest cards. Nothing really amazing there, except for the tiny three-card hands. And most important is when you get to the partnership game with four or six players. At this point, you start cluing your partners as to which cards in the trump suit you have. And there is very traditional signaling to your partners to indicate which trump cards you have. For the ace, stretching your lips over your teeth. Three, distorting your mouth to one side. The king is glancing upwards. Queen, knight, showing the tip of your tongue. Jack, shrugging a shoulder. But this is actually a traditional part of the game, something that's bound into the rules. The signals are standard, apparently, like everyone knows them.
So your opponents are seeing you do that, so you have to
hopefully not
subtle about it.
Yeah, totally.
That's weird.
Yeah, catch their eye.
Yeah.
It's like formalized cheating.
Old card games are weird. There was just a whole lot of times where, yeah, we're just going to put the cards in a different order, and sometimes there are 12 cards in a suit, and sometimes there are 15, and we're just making stuff up. And I think half of it was, so the house would, like, nobody can remember all these rules, so we're going to make money when you screw something up. Briscola, I think, came up not only because it has the interesting gestures, but it also ties into a game that we'll be talking about in a little bit.
Soon, yes.
Foreshadowing.
Yeah.
One that I wanted to mention in here is Gunboat Diplomacy. This is a variant of Diplomacy, which is Alan Kalhammer's game from 1959, originally published by Avalon Hill. We've talked about Diplomacy before, and it's a game in which every unit has a force of one, and you can only get somewhere if you have other units supporting yours, and functionally, you can't progress in the game without getting someone to help you, but also you're eventually going to have to betray anyone who helps you. So it is a game, as the name implies, of Diplomacy. Gunboat Diplomacy is a variant in which you don't communicate with people. The only signal you can give them as to what you're doing is by actually writing your orders. So it's like, if I send a navy from Marseille to the English Channel, that is signaling that I want to head towards England. And if England sees that, maybe they know, or maybe they bounce me there, and maybe that means, all right, we're agreeing to have detente there, or whatever it is. It's a weird game because Diplomacy itself is so based on communication and that sort of thing. Reducing it to a straight tactical exercise where there's no way to communicate or plan with people seems like a non-starter to me, but it has gone on for a very long time. It's not clear who first invented the variant, but it is actually one of the most popular ones now, possibly because it's a good way to learn the rules of the game, but I don't know.
What does it do for speed? It seems like it would.
It is a lot faster because you don't have to write fancy, you know, letters and communicate with everybody and work out your plans. The other thing is there are versions of Gunboat where you can send out what they call press, you know, you can send out communications, but they all have to be sent out publicly.
Yeah, okay.
So that is an interesting variation on the theme, but doesn't really match what we're talking about here. Anyway, I'm sure that people who play a lot of Gunboat Diplomacy could talk at length about, you know, what the significance is of moving a Turkish army to Smyrna on turn one, but I don't know. I don't quite get it. I like Diplomacy as long as I'm not playing with people that I want to have a continuing friendship with. I'm not sure Gunboat appeals to me, but it's an interesting variant.
How weird.
Yeah, that's my thought.
So, that brings us to 1985 with Pictionary. This was published by Angel Games Incorporated and designed by Rob Angel. I mean, this, much like Charades, is, I think at this point, just a well-known parlor game in which you have a pad of paper and a marker, usually divided into small teams. One person on the team is drawing out a subject on the pad of paper, and the others have to guess what that object is, usually within a time limit. Pictionary is Pictionary. Now, what's interesting is, I think, the games that now incorporate Pictionary in interesting ways, right? Like, we've talked before about games like Telestrations, which I think is now probably better known by the internet game of Gardic Phone,
yeah.
Where The first person draws a picture of a subject, and then the next person looks at that picture and needs to guess what the subject is, and then the following person takes that person's guess, sketches it again.
The cycle repeats. It's playing telephone, only with pictures.
Yeah. Which telestrations I find incredible fun. The thought of playing Pictionary does not appeal to me at all.
And the nice thing is there are a lot of more recent games that have taken that basic Pictionary idea and done weird things with it. There's A Fake Artist Goes to New York, which is Pictionary, but with a hidden traitor.
Which is actually great, actively great.
It is fascinating. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of hidden traitor games in general, but this one's great because basically everybody knows what you're drawing except one person, and they have to try and contribute to the group drawing without indicating that they have no idea what it is.
Yeah, I like Artist Goes to New York because it's actively hilarious.
That's also the one where you can only draw like a single
line. You get one line. Yeah. Yeah.
Each person gets one line contributing to a central picture, but one of the people doesn't know what's going on. So you have to kind of like prove to everyone that like, yeah, I know what's happening here.
I don't know what's happening here.
Yeah. So basically the guesser and the fake artist have no idea what's going on at the start of the game.
It has the same fun as Spyfall, yeah. In essence, right?
Yeah, it's Spyfall with pictures.
Yeah.
And then, Frank, there was another one you were mentioning.
Yeah, Really Bad Art, which is basically you're given a concept, and it's literally often a concept, like synchronicity or something sometimes.
Oh, Jesus.
It's something often crazy. It can vary between crazy and...
So you draw a red line, a blue line, and a yellow line. Sorry, I'm dating myself.
No, that's too complicated. But all you have to do is you don't have to get across because everyone sees the card. Everyone draws at the same time. And you hand out the cards and the drawings. And you have to line up the cards and the drawings and just match them. So you just have to be different enough to explain synchronicity versus baseball. The thing is that timer for Really Bad Art, and there is a timer, is 5 seconds long. You hit it and you're like... So you're scribbling like madly for 5 seconds and you produce something that looks with random squiggles. And everyone looks at it and goes, oh yeah, that's synchronicity, isn't it? It's amazing to watch. Yeah.
Fascinating. Who is that one by? That almost sounds like another game.
No, it's like a mass market game. Wonderforge. Oh, Wonderforge is a decent game. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, wow, it's me again. Okay, so...
It is you.
Incognito, again. The game that's clearly inspired by Briscola. This is 1988, published originally by Milton Bradley. The more recent editions are Ares Games, designed by Leo Colavini. And he is an Italian game designer, very Italian, and you can see where the Briscola came in. The game itself doesn't have a lot of communication, but it consists of this gorgeous, elaborate board game of Venice, with all these pawns with little carnival tricorner hats and masks in different sizes, tall, fat. And the game involves figuring out which person each player is, because you are one of those pawns. There's an ambassador that gives you some information. And then there's a giant mask randomizer, which is also part of the game. So you shake the randomizer, you get actions. And depending on what you meet, you can exchange cards with people, which slowly let you clue into who is which person. Basically, you have to show cards that you aren't when you bump into a person. But the final part is that you also have to figure out which role each was. For example, it is actually Lord Fiddlebottom and Colonel Bubble are always partnered against Agent X and Madame Zsa Zsa.
Your names
are just bonkers, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And you can indicate which person you are by using Briscola clues to any player at any time. Ideally,
that's right. It's like the colonel has a wink and the other.
Yeah, and pursed cheeks for Madame Zsa Zsa. Brian said, hey, I'm not sure it's a great game. And yeah, I'm not sure it's a great game, but it's so bizarre and bonkers. I do enjoy playing it.
Yeah, I seem to recall there was like a card game version of it that took out some of the wandering around the map nonsense that I thought worked a little better.
Which is true, and it does. But I still miss the big, giant, plastic randomizer thing And the pawns and everything. I think that's part of the charm of the game for me. So I've actually got a couple copies of the base game. I think I've got the original Milton Bradley and a couple of the Ares editions. I just can't give up on that one.
Okay. It's one of those games that, like I said, I think it's interesting. I don't know that I would ever seek out to play it.
Yeah. Oh, I just occasionally get an urge to grab people and make them play it.
Well, you're weird that way, Frank.
Yep.
And then you had another one.
What? No.
Yes, oh. You, two in a row. Deal with it.
Of course, I'm going to be talking.
Remember, we're in the Frank portion of the podcast, or it's all historical stuff. Yeah,
we're skipping ahead to 2009, so it's not that historical.
Historical!
Oh, shut up.
So this is Ugtect. This was published by Heidelberger Spielverlag, which is actually a distributor in Germany that started publishing their own games about this time. This is one of their earlier ones. And this is by Walter Overt, who did a lot of big dexterity games. He's actually an American designer, I think. Anyway, Ugtect is bonkers. I mean, it's just glorious. You've got a bunch of people who are building little building block sets, just kind of stacking them up. They're colored blocks in different shapes. And then you've got the two actual architects who know what the hell they're doing. Each of them is over their team with a giant inflatable spiked club, which clearly makes it the best game.
This is a caveman theme, in case that's not clear from the giant club.
But the way they're allowed to communicate is that, first of all, they've got, for each color piece, they've got a card that everyone can see with specific motions. Like putting your hands together above your head, that's red. Stomping your feet, that's white. Shrugging your shoulders is gray piece. And then you have a number of words. Sorry, this is a little bit
cheap. You're already breaking the rules, Frank.
So if you say ungungu, that means you take. If you say ungungu, ungunu, that's put away.
God.
So words is maybe generous. A little generous here.
That is completely different from kongaroo, which is make upper, and kongaroo, kongaroo, which is make lower. Manangu is make front. Manangu, manangu, twice is make back. And then if they get it correct, you bonk them on the head with the club. If they get it wrong, you bonk them on the head twice with the club. Oh. And if you bonk yourself on the head, that means cancel. That's kind of your communication structure.
And I'm looking at the cards. These are not simple structures that you're trying to get people to put together.
Now, it usually quickly devolves into just hysterical laughter. And anyone walking by is like, Frank made you play this, right? Which is usually the case.
That's, I mean, I feel like this is one of those games that's fun for about 5 minutes.
Agreed.
And then at that point, you've kind of got the gimmick and it's like, all right, we can put this away now.
Yeah, I mean, it'll reduce people to tears. About 30 minutes is all you want. And you can't bring it out a lot.
Yeah.
Because it's not, it's a fun game. But it is just the visual bonkers and ludicrousness of it.
Literally bonkers, yeah.
Yeah, totally.
So that's definitely a game. The next one is one that is, again, I feel like more of an activity than the game. It's sort of charadesy in a way, but also different. And I'm not sure it really works, but I'm really interested by it. I say that a lot with these games. And this is Concept, which was released in 2013 by Gaetan Bourgeonneau and Alain Rivollet by Repost Productions. And this is a very pretty execution of kind of a complicated guess what I'm thinking, guess what's on the card kind of thing. So you've got a big board in front of you, which has a bunch of little spaces on it that all have symbols on them. And those symbols might be different colors or things that indicate solid, liquid, gas, person, place, thing, male, female, movie, TV, book, all the different categories or clues of things that you're going on. And the person who is giving clues basically puts a series of tokens on those various pictures to indicate this is the thing I'm trying to get you to guess. For something like beer, you might put, there's one that says this is the primary thing that it is, and you might put that on liquid. And then you put one on yellow, and then you put one on food and drink, and then somebody guesses lemonade, and you grumble to yourself, and then eventually you can work out to get them to guess beer. But then if you have to convey something like Ryan Reynolds, it gets a lot more difficult. Because it's like, okay, man, movie.
Black and red.
Death, black, red, water, trying to get Deadpool out of it. it's conceptually very interesting as you try and go through and figure out what combination of things can I do to make this happen. And obviously, the fewer clues you do it in, the better you are. But it's, I don't know.
You know what that description actually makes me think about is it's a new game that, again, popular on computer, where it's basically you start with like fire, earth, air, and water, and then you combine things to get other things.
Oh, like Doodle God?
Yeah, this one is supposedly, I think it's probably AI powered in some way because you can end up with anything.
Huh.
But like I've seen a bunch of people doing that online recently, and it's that where it's like, well, cool, if I start with nothing and I want to end up with Concept the board game, what things would I need to combine to get it? And because this is AI powered, it can do that, I guess.
Now, I think I know there's an entire category of games like Cultist Simulator, where you're basically just combining cards forever. And it's right. More exploring the card combinations. Those are actually curated card combinations, unless there's a new version of those.
I think this is a new one. I'll
yeah, see if you can find out.
It. We'll put a link into the
show. Yeah, for one, welcome our new AI overlords.
Yeah.
Yep.
But yeah, Concept is basically a game of increasingly complicated Venn diagrams. You know, what's a person who's also a liquid? How is that even happen?
Slimmer.
Exactly. Very good. Mike. You have a future in this game. Although I seem to recall you're not a big fan of it.
Like, the game is very, you need to be in the groupthink, and groupthink is just not a thing for me.
Sandy's a big fan, but in general, when we drag it out, and actually I'm a big fan as well, but when we drag it out, generally we don't even bother to keep score. So it is does really.
Oh, yeah. It's like definitely more really an activity than a game.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it is interesting, and I feel like there are ways in which that kind of mechanism could be used.
Hold that thought.
Oh, more foreshadowing.
Holding.
So, all these games aren't gamey enough. Let's play a more gamey game.
Okay.
I was recently killed.
Oh, no.
And I'm a ghost.
No, no.
And all of you are mediums, and you need to figure out who killed me, what they killed me with, and where they killed me. Only by the crazy dreams that I give you.
So wait, you're dead and you're making us play Clue?
Yes, exactly. It's like I get to torture you all, and also, it's great. The game is Mysterium, or originally, Tainichim Demosvo, which was the Portal Games version that was in...
Czech, I want to say, or Polish?
That's the Polish version, which is not the original. The game is actually Ukrainian in origin.
It was designed by Alexander Nevsky and Olav Sidorenko, and it is a fascinating game mostly because the artwork in the game is extremely fascinating, right? So the deck of cards you have that are dreams are very... It is clear that someone said to a bunch of artists, go make me a bunch of weird art, and the artist was really excited to go make a bunch of weird art because the dream art is really compelling and interesting and like... unusual to the extreme.
It's very reminiscent of
Dixit.
Mm-hmm.
Dixit, right?
Mm-hmm. There's just a bunch of weird symbology and animals wearing clothes and things that don't make sense. Yeah.
But much weirder, even.
It is, yeah. And I will say that I think I like the art from the Polish version better.
Agreed.
Although the components in the American version are splendid.
If you go back to the Ukrainian version, you get these lovely seance, like Madame Leota crystal balls.
Which they have in the US version as well.
Oh, you're right. True.
The thing that's, I think, fascinating about this game, right? It's like, obviously, the ghosts, all you do is, on your turn, give out one or more dreams to each person, which is indicating, you know, you kind of start at, I think, place, then you do person, then you do, like, murder item.
I think person is first, but anyway, yeah.
Person might be first. And you give them some number of dreams that they have to kind of interpret. And all the art is very busy, right? So there's a lot of stuff going on. So you could be like, oh, well, I'm going to do this thing that has some cogs in it and this thing that has some wheels in it, trying to indicate the race car driver, right? But if the person who gets them doesn't pick up on the spanning clue, they might be like, oh, this thing has like knives and this thing has forks, so it's probably the chef.
Or all of these cards have a lot of red in them, so it must be this person who's wearing red.
Right.
And it's like, you have a set of, I think it's like number of players plus two characters and weapons and places that they're trying to choose from. Mm-hmm. But inevitably, they are making the wrong conclusions from the cards you give them.
Mm-hmm. When you haven't made your selection, you get to keep your dreams from previous rounds so you can kind of build off of them a little bit. Or just drive your players insane. It's one of the two.
This one's weird because there's the original versions. The Lilibud version added a lot of tokens and other mechanics. I've actually never played the Lilibud version. And then they did a Mysterium Parks, which goes back to the original rule set, which is just, you know, you basically play a card. But there was a lot of point tokens and elaborate board for tracking your cards. Do you know what differences there are in that version? Because I've not played it.
I know in the...
in the US version, there's a whole gamification of like betting yeah. on...
I think you're right, I think you're wrong. Yeah.
People's votes. Like, I think you're right, I think you're wrong. Yeah. If you're right or wrong, you get like... the more points you accumulate by being right on those guesses, mm-hmm. right? Whether you're guessing someone is correct or someone is incorrect, you get more points at the end of the game. And so the final round where you're making the final guess, you get yeah. more information.
Never really liked the ending.
Yeah, I think the end game in the original version was cleaner.
Yeah, and it had far less rules. Again, if you're curious, the Mysterium Parks game is, I think, the way to go and start. Because that's really the original rules. Trimmed down, it's a tiny box of cards.
And it's in a creepy circus, so how can you go wrong?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah, I mean, more art like mm-hmm. that, I'm in.
Yeah, it's an interesting game. It's one of my favorite games like this, in terms of games where you're kind of giving people imagery and trying to convey a message. I might switch back to the original stuff, and I'll have to take a look at Mysterium Park, because it does look like it's a streamlined version with the same thing going on.
Yeah.
Brian, why don't we play Obscurio, the game where we play this game, but there's also a hidden
traitor. Let's not. You know, I was fascinated by the concept of this, but, and I'll be honest, I haven't played it. But I feel like these games are difficult enough to kind of convey what you're talking about. And when you have another person who is actively trying to force people to the wrong conclusion, I don't know.
It's so easy to do that.
I would think.
It makes it kind of not fun.
Yeah.
So the one difference in Obscure that makes it a little easier is you are, as a group, trying to agree on something, as opposed to everybody has their own individual thing, which helps a little bit. But you're right, the secret traitor thing is rough. Though you can, like, declare someone is the secret traitor. Now you all know, like, there's a mechanical way to be like, you're the secret traitor, and the game will indicate yes or no kind of thing.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, there was a stretch going on for a while, and frankly, it's still going on today, where people want to take everything and say, well, what if existing good game, but with a hidden traitor? And a lot of times, it's just not good.
Or yeah, the stretch goal is the hidden traitor mode.
Right, exactly. So, speaking of games that have a hidden traitor now that don't need them...
I mean, I've never played that version of this game, so I have no idea.
That's true, that's a new one that's just come out.
Yeah.
So... a game that I think is actually wonderfully fun. I often fondly think of this game from when we first got introduced to it, which was at a secret board game con. And you could tell when a group was playing Magic Maze because there'd be a tense silence from that corner of the room for about 2 minutes. And then everyone would hoop and holler and laugh and scream as the timer ran out and they either were successful or not successful.
Punctuated by occasional tapping of a wooden pawn.
I was going to say, no, it wasn't silence. You just hear fine. Tap, 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 tap.
The occasional growl. I mean, yeah.
Yes.
The first couple stages in Magic Maze, you can talk. So as you're learning the rules, you can kind of discuss with each other what's going on. But after like the third map, and so there's a series of a bunch of maps in the game. After the third map, you no longer can talk to people. It has to be totally in silence. And when you want someone to do something, you have something called the do something pawn, which you can tap in front of a person indicating, hey, I need you to do something.
You to move
and
a piece.
Let's talk about what people do. So
just before we get into that, did we do the designer and everything?
Oh, yes. The publisher is Sit Down. The designer is Casper Lapp. And so in Magic Maze, you're given a tile, and your tile might say, hey, I can move pawns north, or I can move pawns south, or I can move pawns through elevators, or I can use magic portals, or I can, like, investigate new tiles. Everybody's playing at the same time. And everybody has a direction and might potentially have like a secondary power, which is like using portals or revealing tiles or doing other things.
Escalators.
Using escalators. And as a group, you're guiding a group of adventurers. So they recently had a very unlucky time in the dungeon, and they lost all their equipment. So they have come to the magical mall to steal new equipment and escape with their new equipment. So you need to navigate all these pawns to a specific location of their color, and then once everybody gets to the position of their color, then everybody needs to get out. In the later games, everybody needs to get out at a specific location in the earlier rule sets, right? As you're kind of learning the rules, it starts as like a single exit, then everybody eventually has their own individual exit. So you can move people north, right? And so like, hey, some pawn somewhere needs to be moved north, and someone is just tapping the do something pawn in front of you, and you're desperately scanning the board like, what needs to move north right now?
Oh, no, what's even better is there are four pawns to move, so somebody taps at you, you move a pawn, and then they just continue to tap at you. But unbeknownst to you, that movement that you just did totally screwed somebody else who was trying to get that pawn to somewhere, so now they're frustrated. It's great.
This is one of those games that, I don't know, I'm not sure fun is the right word to describe it. I find it extremely stressful.
Oh, yeah. It is extremely stressful.
We have a limited amount of time, and we have to get all these things to all these places, and you've been moving that guy over there, and now you want me to do something with him. I don't know where he's trying to go. And, you know, there are brief places where you can move on that kind of stop the timer and let you actually communicate as human beings with words. But it's really well put together the way that every additional level adds new complexities and difficulties and challenges. Hi, here's a door that is short, so only the dwarf can go through it. Okay,
so,
great.
Brian, I will say, I thought this would be a good game to play with my brother and his family, since he's got two young kids. And they liked it well enough, except my sister-in-law agrees with you. She does not like to play this game because of how extremely stressful somebody tapping at her became.
Mm-hmm. That is the best concept in the game, the do something pawn. It is always hilarious when you're not the person being tapped at. And as we kind of referred to at the start, there has been an expansion to Magic Maze called Hidden Roles, in which one of the players doesn't actually want everybody to get out. If somebody figures out that it's them, somebody else gets to take over their action and do it for them. So it's supposedly a very subtle thing. And I don't know, man. This is another game that does not need that.
It goes back to that same thing where because that game is already so tightly wound, it is so easy to just screw people over that, again, it becomes unfun.
Yeah.
But that is their new expansion. They have another one that is Maximum Security, which just adds more stuff, which I think is totally fine.
Sure. And I mean, I imagine if there are people that play Magic Maze a lot, I mean, for me, Magic Maze is a sometimes food, but I imagine if you play it a lot, there's a point where it's like you've got a system down, you kind of know how everybody works, and maybe you need more challenges, and that Hidden Traitor is going to be part of it. I don't play this game enough to think that that is a thing that I need in my life.
Yeah, I'm not the kind of person who can imagine that Hidden Traitor in that sort of game is fun.
Yeah, so the one issue I have with these kind of games, this one particularly bad, is that the rules that get added on, whenever you play it, you're often playing with new people, or there's some new person, and they're just, you can't play with the advanced stuff because you've got the new person and they're trying to grasp the rules in real time. That's
you have to go back
stupid
to the beginning.
Real-time complexities. Space Alert thing. Why you can never play Space Alert.
I don't know. We had a Space Alert campaign going.
Yes. Same players. Go you.
If you can get a regular group, it's a lot of fun.
Although, I think we have exactly like one or two games into that campaign.
See?
Space Alert campaign, shut up.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's more of like an organizing humans problem than it is like a game like problem, right?
Yeah,
but you can't add or drop players because, again, they don't have the rules set knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, like I said, I think this kind of hidden role game for this game is long. Just for a group of four or five gamers that get together once a week to play Hidden Maze, and they're like, oh, that's awesome. I'd love more expansion, right? That totally works for that kind of group.
I just can't see playing Magic Maze that much. It's a good game, don't get me wrong, but my heart could not handle playing that on a regular basis. Next one I wanted to mention is one that we've talked about before, and I will keep talking about it because I think it deserves more love than it gets, and that is the Shipwreck Arcana. This was a 2017 release from Kevin Bishop at Merrimorph Games, and this is a cooperative deduction game. So everybody has a set of tiles in front of them from 1 to 7, and there's a bag that has, I think, 3 sets of tiles in it from 1 to 7. And basically, each turn, you have 2 secret tiles in front of you. You might have, I don't know, a 3 and a 5. And there are a set of cards in front of you, and those cards restrict what numbers you can play on them or when you can play on there. So a card might be, if one of your tiles is a 4, 5, or 6, play the other one here. And then you put your 3 on there. And then, without you saying anything further, other than just playing that one tile in the game, the rest of the group has to get together and discuss and figure out, okay, well, if he had a 1 or a 2 or a 7, he couldn't have played here. So if he had a 6, he would have made more sense to play on this other card, which would have given us more information. So it's a game of kind of think and double think of trying to figure out, what did he mean by playing there? Was that his only option? Is that the thing that gave us best information? You have to sort of assume that your fellow players are playing optimally in order to get the information. There's more mechanics to it. There's like, after you use a card a certain number of times, it goes out of play. And if you didn't have a correct guess that turn, you lose points. It's just a really fascinating game. It's got a little bit of the same thing as something like Mysterium, where you're putting down a piece of information and desperately hoping that people will draw the right conclusions from it. But I like it better than Mysterium.
It's the other brain hemisphere.
Because it is simple math. This is logic. This is why I'm placing it this way, rather than, I wonder what the mouse on a skateboard means.
I think the worst part about this game is being the person who needs to place a pawn. And then you're thinking it through and you're like, okay, I've got it. There's no way this could go wrong. And then they start discussing something and you're just sitting there going,
oh no.
Fuck.
I forgot that.
I didn't see that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a tremendous amount of fun. I think it's a great little game. There is an expansion to it, which adds a bunch more and more complicated cards, which I would not start with.
But I would totally finish with. I think they do add to the game.
They do add a lot, but there are cases where, like, you're starting the game and you get 4 of those advanced cards into play, and you're just, like, staring at the board for 10 minutes, like, I think I know what's going on. But it's got really great little art, I should say. They're like tarot-sized cards. And yeah, it's just really well put together and clever and a lot of fun to play.
Yeah, the cards themselves are really well done. They don't really have anything to do with anything on the mechanics of the game.
Yeah, it is like kind of a weird retro-futurist tarot kind of thing, almost.
Yeah, it gives me vibes of like Art Deco, almost.
Yeah, a little bit. Anyway, Shipwreck Arcana, good game. I recommend you check it out if you haven't, and if that sounds like something that would interest you.
Be warned, this is a lot of math.
I mean, when you say math, it's like adding 2 single-digit numbers together. I mean, for some people, that's a lot of math, I guess.
It's so much math.
Ready for the next game?
Hit me.
Okay, first of all, for this game, what I'm going to do is tell you that it's $20 on Amazon, and I'm putting the link into our Zoom chat.
Somebody's trying
really
to get some
trying
points.
To get some points.
Just going to listen for the dominoes to fall. So First Contact was originally called Premier Contact, designed by Demir Kushnodinov, published by Cosmodrome Games originally, which is a Russian publisher. And this is kind of a Stargate Codenames Arrival kind of scenario. Basically, you divide into 2 teams. One represents aliens who are basically coming to Earth, and the other represents ancient Egyptians who are basically meeting the aliens for the first time. And there's so much weird about this game. First of all, there are 2 winners, but it's 1 alien and 1 Egyptian. So you're not really on teams. You're competing against the person on your side. And the 2 sides have completely different goals. For the Egyptians, it's to figure out the alien's language. For the aliens, it's to get a number of items, generally 4 to 6 items. And these items are very code namesy. You've got a 5x5 grid laid down facing in front of you of double side cards with, you know, just pictures of objects and names, you know, and they're traditional Egyptian, just generic objects, chair, snake, whatever. You've also got, everyone has a list of 25 words, and these are the communication for the game. But the aliens actually have a version of these 25 words that each has a rune on it, some kind of weird little alien squiggle. So the object of the humans is to actually provide the correct item to aliens, as well as to learn the language that the aliens are speaking. So there's two phases to a round. First, each of the humans chooses 1 to 5 of the objects at the table, and then the aliens show a rune. Well, hopefully this is the keys to one of the words. So hopefully this is like big, you know. I picked the big things and the aliens wrote down a rune. I'm pretty sure that's big, I hope.
So it's like what these things have in common.
Again, you have a list of 25 words. So you're establishing the communications for what that word is. But each of the Egyptians, you know, asks and tries to get a clue on a word. They may differ because they're competing. Humans aren't working together. They're each got their own chart and writing down something different. So they may have a different idea what that rune you wrote down means. Same thing, the aliens might have just screwed up and given you totally bogus clues.
Mm-hmm.
Then each of the aliens goes and they write down a series of runes on the pad and then show it to all the humans, who then each try to give them an item by secretly marking on a 5x5 grid. And if they're correct in giving them the item, the humans get a point, the alien gets to mark off his item. And you keep going until one of the aliens has gotten all their items. That alien wins, and the person who's correctly given the most items, or the human that's given the most items, wins. The game is just a weird back and forth of, wait, what, that rune, what does that mean? And when the aliens are asking for items, they can write down a whole series of runes, including runes that they haven't seen yet, but which may give them a clue as to what that really means.
Huh.
And so you're basically communicating back and forth using these 25 runes that hopefully are tied to words and concepts. You also do have a knot by putting a line above a rune. That means the inverse. So, you know.
Not that, yeah. Huh?
It's a pretty amazing game.
I'm not giving you a point yet. I am provisionally interested, but would like to play
it. Yeah, and I do think it has some of that concept idea, but with more structure. Yeah,
it feels a lot like that. And also now it's like, I don't know that this means round or yellow or a line.
Yeah, you're not certain. You basically have an idea of that rune, but the game totally works.
Hmm.
And again, it feels kind of like Codenames, but no, it doesn't really. I mean, it's got the 5x5 grid and you're, you know, doing group selection. But it's also weird in that the people sitting on the side of the screen with you are your opponents.
Huh. Yeah, I would like to play sometime because it sounds like the kind of thing that I would totally enjoy. Yeah.
But yeah, it works. It's clever. Oh man, I failed. No one bought it yet. Okay. I feel so.
Hey, you got so many points last week. Don't worry about that. You're right.
I think my favorite game on this list is The Crew and its sequel, Expand Alone, The Crew Mission Deep Sea.
Right.
It is a trick-taking game, but at the start of the round, there are a set of rules that you have to follow while taking tricks. So it might be, hey, this player, the player who gets this rule, has to take the two of... What suits? They're like colors,
yeah, it's just
right?
Like red, yellow, blue, green, I think.
Blue, green, yellow, pink. It's like, hey, you might have to take the two of blue is your personal mission. And that's face-up information. This is not a surprise to anyone. But much like bridge or other trick-taking games, you're not allowed to talk about the cards that are in your hand except for one very specific way, which is you have a communication token. And you can put a single card on the table and place your communication token on it. And you are required to put your communication token in one of three places. If you put it in the middle of the card, then that is indicating that that is your only card. And so, for example, if you gotten the position where you need to take the two blue, and that is your only blue card. That is something you need to share with people immediately so the game doesn't explode. You can only put it in the center if it's your only card of that color. If it's not the only card of that color, you can either share that it is your highest card of that color or the lowest card of that color. So if you had a middle card, you couldn't present it because you can't present information on it. You can only share either the singular card, highest card, or lowest card, and each player gets to share one piece of information over the hand, over the set of tricks. And so both the crew and Deep Sea Mission are tons of fun, mm-hmm. and it's like, you know, this shared puzzle element, right? Because everybody's working together, and you're just trying to make sure that whoever has the rule about them is doing the right thing. Like, there's one mission early on in the original game where one of the players feels sick, and so they can't take any hands. And so at the start of the game, each player gets to say, either gets to indicate they are feeling good with a thumbs up or feeling bad with a thumbs down. And then the captain, who is the person who drew the four of rockets, they are the captain of that round, gets to decide who is going to not take any tricks. And it can't be the captain in that context because there's a wild suit, which is the rocket suit in the base game. And it trumps over kind of anything else. And as it follows the same rules around what cards you can play into a check, you have to follow suit. And if you can't follow suit, you can play a different suit into it and it just goes away. It has no effect. Or you can play a rocket and trump it up. There's a bunch of missions that get harder and harder in both the crew Quest for Planet 9 and the crew Mission Deep Sea. I think if you were going to start with one, I would say Mission Deep Sea is all the goodness of Quest for Planet 9. And I like the way it does mission-y stuff is a little better, I think. They learned a lot from the first release. But they're both excellent games. If you and your crew are interested in this kind of like trick-taking, puzzly kind of experience, they're both excellent games.
Yeah, if you like trick-taking games at all, these are definitely well worth looking into. If you're not familiar with trick-taking games, it'll probably take a little bit to kind of get used to the mechanics and how they flow. But it's a tremendous amount of fun watching the different parameters evolve out as you go and trying to figure out ways to get the right people, the right cards. They're really good.
Mm-hmm. They also travel really well. Mm-hmm. They're really small, right? So like you can very easily toss it in a backpack and go.
Yeah.
Not a problem.
I will say this game also does my favorite thing, which is when you lay out all the cards, one through whatever, it makes a little panorama of artwork, and it's amazing.
You do love panoramas. That's why we need to play Seventh Citadel, Mike.
I mean, twist my arm, Brian. Twist my arm.
Just me twisting. Mike, how do you get along with your roommates?
I mean, my roommates and I, we don't communicate well enough about the things that we would like to decorate our house with.
That's a shame.
I hate it, Mike. You don't even know what it is, Joe. I found a brain in a jar at a garage sale, and I think it's perfect for the living room. Y'all, this is Decorum, which is perhaps one of my favorite games on this list. It's a 2022 Floodgate Games production that is designed by Charlie Mukin. And this is the game of tandem interior decorating.
I've heard it described as the game of passive-aggressive roommates.
Yeah, I mean, yes.
Accurate.
There are a bunch of scenarios, weirdly, most of which are tailored to a two-player experience. It has a whole, like, campaign for two players. So if you've got a significant other that you would like to solve puzzles about interior decorating with, I think this is a great option. But there are several three- and four-player missions as well. And each mission, each player will receive a bulleted list of things that they need to make happen in the apartment. For example, you might get something that says, you need to have more green objects, including wall paint, than any other color in the house. But your other players also have objectives they would like to accomplish, which may immediately seem like they are contradictory, but they have been mathed out to always be possible. So you will never have, I need more green, I need more blue in the same game. And then mechanically, you just go around one at a time. You can, on your turn, take an object and place it from the board into the house. You can remove an object from the house. I think that's it.
You can swap objects.
Oh, you can swap an object in the house with one that is on the sideboard. But you can only pass if your personal goals have already been met. However, other people who have not yet met their personal objectives cannot pass. You must do something. And so you can't really tell each other what your objectives are until the end of every fifth turn, in which you have a house meeting. And you pick one of your objectives and one of your other players, and you just share something with them about what you want. So now they know one of your three objectives, and they can help you achieve that objective. So it is very much a what is most important to tell to who at this time.
This is a delightfully aggravating game.
Yes, yes.
It's like, why do you keep putting that yellow lamp in the kitchen? I hate that. And he's like, well, I have to have a yellow lamp in the kitchen, so I have to figure out another way to get my goal. I haven't played the two-player game, although that looks really interesting. The four-player games, particularly at the higher difficulty levels, get a little insane in terms of the things you have to do. It's the sort of thing where everybody has an individual goal that's like, I need to have a lamp in every room in the house, and they need to be in color order going clockwise around the board. And if everybody has one of those for a different object, there's often exactly one way to fill out the board that will accomplish that. And trying to do it while nobody knows what anybody else wants to do is an exercise in frustration and logic and deduction, and it's a lot of fun in a tearing your hair out kind of way.
Yep, agreed. There are difficulty ratings on each of the objectives, and so I think the higher level difficulties do have fewer possible solutions, or in a perfect world where everybody can see everything, would have longer steps that you would need to take from the starting position to the final position.
Mm-hmm. Very nicely made. There is like a regular version and a deluxe version. In the deluxe version, the item tokens are like these thick acrylic chunky pieces.
And
I think it's like $5 more on Amazon the last time I looked at it. Definitely get the deluxe version if you can.
There is on BGG an expansion coming out and listed for 2024 called Moving Out that I'm excited about. I am curious if they add more tokens, if they will also have those in acrylic. I can't see how they would.
I think they would have to make them available at least, possibly for an additional surcharge. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. The last one I wanted to talk about is a little game called Sky Team. What's funny about that?
Oh, there's just, I know of the game, I've heard, I've yet to play it, but it just sounds like a game of blood and death and doom.
And horrible crashing. Yeah, this is a Sky Team 2023 release from Scorpion Masque, designed by Luc Raymond, and it is a two-player game about landing an airplane in which you can't talk to your co-pilot. So that seems like a bad plan. Basically, each turn, you and your co-pilot roll a couple dice behind your screen, and then you take turns placing them out on the board. One player is responsible for like the flaps and the landing gear, and another person is responsible for communicating with the tower, and another thing that I can't remember off the top of my head, but everybody's got individual responsibilities. And there are also collective things that you have to do to manage the planes, like altitude and direction. So, for instance, each of you is going to play a die on the plane's attitude, I think it's called. It's basically, how is it rotated to the left or right? Are the wings level or turned in one direction or the other? And basically, the difference between those two dice is how much the plane shifts in one direction or the other. And of course, you don't know what your partner has rolled. So you're just putting a die and hoping they can do the same thing to keep you straight. Your respective dice plays determine how far forward or closer to the airport the plane gets. Every turn, regardless of how much closer you get, you drop a step in altitude. So there is a very real limitation of how many turns you have to get all this stuff accomplished. But it's weird how much communication you can get out of just placing a die in a particular place. It's like, well, I'm putting this six here, and that's a terrible place to put a six, which probably tells you that my other die is also a six, and I don't have anything better to put there. So I hope to God you can do something with that information. It's another game that I think takes a couple plays for people to learn what they're doing and avoid crashing the plane and killing everybody on board. It's very nicely put together, lots of great little components. The board is sort of this airplane cockpit instrument panel. It's a two-layer board with slots for the dice and a little acrylic thing you use to adjust the position of the plane. There are many ways to fail this game. It takes a long time to get to a point where you can win, but it's extremely cleverly done, and I think definitely worth a look if you have two players that would like to practice their nonverbal communication by placing dice and silently screaming at each other on the inside when you do the wrong thing.
This one has been on my shortlist for a while. The problem is that it's two-player.
Yeah.
I just don't play those very often.
Yeah, it's one of those that I really would like to get at more, but as you say, if people are coming over to play games, there's usually more than just one other person.
Mm-hmm.
The nice thing is it plays short, so it's the kind of thing where it's like if you're having people over, you could be like, hey, come over 30 minutes early and we'll get in a game or two of Sky Team before everybody else gets here kind of thing.
Yeah, or if you've got like two games going on and one of them finishes early, you can kind of knock out a few of these while waiting for the other game to finish kind of thing.
Yeah, or if you've got somebody there and then everybody else is running late, like, great.
Yeah, but it's a beautiful little game, very well put together. Again, not easy, but a lot of fun. I think that's all the games we have to talk about.
I think so.
So we're going to end this episode with a period of nonverbal communication in which I silently urge all of you to leave us an iTunes review. No, I'm not going to do that. That would be silly.
Brian is wildly gesticulating right now, like arms just going everywhere.
Yes, exactly. I'm pointing to the iTunes and the keyboard. And yeah, you'll get it. You'll figure it out. It's fine. If there are any good games that you guys know about that have that nonverbal communication going on, we'd love to hear about them. Next month, I think we're going to try something a little bit different.
Oh.
We're going to take one of our favorite games and do a little bit of a deep dive on it. So hopefully it will be as interesting to you as we're intending it to be for us. We should have Jason and Curtis back and get the whole crew back together to complain about games and generally talk about things. Anything else really cool going on that people want to share or plug or discuss while we got everybody here?
No.
I just got my copy of Divinity Original Sin, so I'm excited to play that at some point.
That is quite nice.
I have heard many good things about that.
Y'all can always come see me play board games on Sundays on my stream.
That's very true. Twitch.tv/CodabGames. And for me, I did receive my copy of Seventh Citadel, which is a lot like Seventh Continent, but looks much more multiplayer friendly, and I'm really anxious to get it to the table with a group.
We've been doing a lot of Deep Rock Galactic, which I am committing to painting, so, and buying all the expansions.
It must be serious, then.
We are waiting for the more campaign-y stuff to come out for that game.
Yeah, one of the expansions has like all the personal upgrade stuff that I really want from that game. But it's a great game. Totally. I really enjoy it.
I want to play more games with you guys. Let's do things.
You should. Yeah.
We always say that. All right. Well, I think that's it for us this month. Again, thank you for listening, and we will talk at you again next month. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of The Ascent of Board Games, which is protected by the Creative Commons license. Opening and closing music is Evening Melodrama by Kevin MacLeod via Incompetech.com. Full details can be found at ascentofboardgames.com. Please share, like, subscribe, review, and comment on this podcast. And thank you for listening.
I think that came from Wikipedia because I am nothing if not diligent in my research.